Slide 15, is that right?
Yeah.
Have I talked about this already? I can't remember. Okay, so I introduced the notion that there are two subcategories of covalent bonds, which are polar and nonpolar. And what is it that distinguishes the two? What is different about a polar bond versus a nonpolar bond? Well, they're both covalent bonds, right? So by definition, there's a sharing of electrons. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a covalent bond. It would be an ionic bond if there was a one-way transfer of electrons. But if they're sharing, it's covalent. And the difference between the two kinds of covalent bonds is that the sharing doesn't have to be equal sharing or fair sharing, so to speak. In a nonpolar covalent bond, there is an equal sharing of that pair of electrons. Remember that every single bond, covalent bond, is a pair of electrons that's shared, not just one, because each of the two participating atoms is sharing one, so there's a pair overall that's shared. What I mean by equal sharing is that that shared pair of electrons that forms the bond is spending time, equal time, around both of the atomic nuclei. And that's what holds them together, of course. But there can be unequal sharing. So it's still sharing in that case, and therefore it's still a covalent bond. But unequal sharing means that the shared pair of electrons spend more time around one of the two atomic nuclei than around the other one. Still holds them together, but the electrons are one at one end or pole of the bond more often than at the other end. And think about what is being shared. They are electrons that are being shared, and they carry a negative charge. So wherever those negative electrons are more often makes that place a little bit more negative. And that's what I was talking about when I introduced the delta notation. Each end of a polar covalent bond has a partial charge, but the end that is slightly negative is denoted as delta minus, lowercase delta. The end of the bond, in other words, the atom, that doesn't have those electrons around it as often is going to be slightly positive. Yeah?
Is there a specific reason why electrons would stay in a specific atom longer than the other?
Yes, and that's what I'm just about to get to, so that's a good question. What would make unequal sharing is another way of asking that. Why would electrons spend more time around one end or one atom than another? And that has to do with a property of any element. All elements have this property, but the values of the property differ. And that property is called electronegativity. You can kind of think of electronegativity as greediness when it comes to sharing electrons. Electronegativity is an expression of how attractive an atom is for electrons. The higher the value, the more greedy that atom is, that kind of atom. So it's willing to strike a deal of sharing, but it wants to cheat and hog the electrons for itself if the value is high. And so there are low electronegative values, medium, and high values. The trend is not perfect, but except for the noble gases, which don't want to have anything to do with gaining or losing electrons, right? They're satisfied. But for the rest of the elements, lower electronegative values are in the lower left, and they get bigger toward the upper right. So they increase from lower left to upper right. And notice when you exclude the noble gases that fluorine is in that top right corner. It has the highest electronegative value, negativity value of all elements. Notice, though, that oxygen is right next door to it, and it's also high. Not the highest, but one of the highest.
Like second, maybe third?
Yes. But I actually don't have the listing memorized. Yeah. You can look them up on ptable.com, which is a hell of an interactive periodic table, by the way. It's in the study links on the Hoffman site. Hydrogen has a much lower electronegativity value than oxygen does. So when an oxygen atom and a hydrogen atom share a pair of electrons to form a covalent bond, an OH bond, which you have two identical ones in water, but let's just look at one of them in isolation, that sharing is unequal because the values of electronegativity for those two participating atoms are quite different from each other. And therefore, whichever atom, in this case it would be oxygen, has the higher value for electronegativity will attract greedily those electrons to itself, and those electrons that are shared will spend more time around that end of the bond than the other. That's why oxygen, specifically in this example, is the one with the delta negative. That's where the electrons are more often, and they are carrying negative charge. The delta positive end is the hydrogen end. They're still there, just not nearly as often. Okay, so that is the definition of a polar covalent bond. When would you expect a covalent bond to be nonpolar? I mean, I told you that already that it's nonpolar if there's equal sharing. But when would that be the case?
Just equal.
When what are equal? When the electronegativity values are equal. At least very close to each other. Now, when would the electronegativity values exactly equal each other?
When it's two of the same element.
Exactly. So consider an oxygen molecule. O2. Oxygen is greedy by itself, but so is the other oxygen. It's just as greedy. No one wins out. So it ends up, since they have identical electronegativity values, that the electrons will be equally shared. And that's a nonpolar bond, therefore. It can be the case, though, that a covalent bond involving two different elements can still be classified as nonpolar, even though, numerically speaking, the electronegativity values are not identical. If they're really close, though, it's going to be nonpolar and won't have the properties that a polar molecule would have. And that brings me to another point. We're talking about bonds so far, which are just part of a molecule. This one has two bonds, this molecule. Well, we classify polar versus nonpolar on a bond-by-bond basis. Each individual bond is either polar or nonpolar. But in a complete molecule, which might have multiple bonds, if the bonds are polar bonds, then that makes the molecule a polar molecule. And water, therefore, is a polar molecule or a polar compound, we would say. And related to what we were just saying about identical values of electronegativity, that's what happens in molecules that are not compounds, right? An oxygen molecule is not a compound. It's a molecule, but it's not a compound because it only has one kind of atom in it. And therefore, it's going to be equal sharing. So molecules can be either compounds or just covalent structures that are elemental. Oxygen gas is elemental. It's just one element. That's not true for salts, by the way, right? Salts or ionic compounds have to be compounds. Why can't you get two ions of the same together? They will repel each other because like charges repel. It's the opposite of sticking together. That's why you're always going to have a metal and a non-metal, a positive ion and a negative ion. So they always form compounds. Molecules don't necessarily form compounds, but they do if there are multiple types of elements used. And sometimes that results in a polar molecule, specifically if the two types of elements bonded together differ greatly in their electronegativity values. But it's also possible to have a compound that's nonpolar because the still different elements that make it up are close enough in their electronegativity values that there's equal sharing of electrons between them. Everyone good with all of that? Now, we have upcoming an entire chapter devoted to the specialness of water, which is why we exist. Water is really defines life, you know, and when we search for extraterrestrial life, really what we're doing, yeah, we say, is there a possibility that water's there? No. Go on, look somewhere else. All of the specialness of water that we're going to discuss in the next chapter springs from the fact that it's a polar molecule. So you wouldn't exist without this fact.
Very extremely polar molecule.
Now in 16, we have a water molecule, but an ammonia molecule as well. And ammonia is NH3, as you see, by the way. Notice what we've been talking about, valence. Nitrogen has a valence of 3. You can tell graphically because it's 3 steps away from the edge, but it has five valence electrons, right? 7 total electrons, but 5 valence electrons, and therefore it's 3 away from 8. Well, valence tells you how many bonds it needs to make if it's part of a molecule. In order to satisfy its valence, it has to make 3 bonds. So it can make 3 individual bonds, which it does in ammonia, with 3 individual hydrogens, each with a valence of 1. Or it can make a double bond and a single bond, or it can make a triple bond. Either way, it adds up to 3. But anyway, back to ammonia, as far as its importance in this figure, is that ammonia is another example of a polar molecule. And so it doesn't have to be water or ammonia. The point above this slide is that when any two polar molecules, whether they're identical to each other, like two waters, or different from each other, like in this example, come together, when they're close to each other, then there will be a swiveling of the molecules so that the partially negative end of one polar molecule will match up against the partially positive end of the other polar molecule. Just like little magnets will swivel toward each other if you get them close to each other. This is electrostatic attraction, just like it works in ionic bonds, but this is not nearly as strong an attraction, and it doesn't keep them together permanently and make them new stuff, which is why this bond, represented by the black dots, is a bond but not a chemical bond. I've already told you that ionic bonds are the weakest chemical bonds. They give you new stuff. This is a bond, but it's much weaker than an ionic bond. It's called a hydrogen bond only because hydrogen is usually involved. It actually doesn't have to be. A hydrogen bond is a bond, a weak attraction between polar molecules because of that partial charge that polar molecules have, which itself is because of unequal sharing of electrons. And because of this swiveling, in a population, we're only seeing a small population here, but you usually have trillions and trillions of particles, that population of polar molecules is going to have a little bit more order to it than a population of nonpolar molecules would be, which are not swiveling around and going in a certain direction. They're just bouncing off of each other, like water, like oxygen molecules in a pure oxygen gas sample. They're not attracted to each other. All right, 17. This tries to explain the shape of water molecules. We've looked at several space-filling models of water already, and you might have been wondering why water is shaped the way it is, kind of bent. it might make more sense for oxygen to be in the middle and one hydrogen on either end, symmetry-wise. But the reason that it doesn't, which is hidden when we just look at this model, is because of electrons around the oxygen. Now, when we draw the electron dot diagram of oxygen, we start by representing the nucleus with the symbol of the atom, which is O. Electron dot diagrams display only valence electrons. We don't care about the lower level electrons. They're shielded by the valence electrons. So there are how many valence electrons for oxygen?
Six.
Six. And what is the valence shell? Two. And how many orbitals are in shell two? Okay, so four sides of this oxygen nucleus represent the four orbitals. You have six electrons you need to put in these four orbitals. So you start by putting just one by itself in a different orbital until you run out of orbitals. And then you still have two more because there's six valence electrons. So you start pairing them up, and it doesn't matter which ones you pair up. I'm just doing this. This shows you that oxygen has two pairs of electrons that are going to remain the property of that oxygen. They are stabler than the others because of that filled orbital. And so they're not going to be shared. They're going to stay with the oxygen. They're not going to be involved in bonds, in other words. But these ones that are lone electrons in a half-filled orbital are going to be shared, because when an atom shares an electron of its own, the other atom is going to be sharing one of its, and it gets credit for both of them, right? So sharing this one will give it credit for an additional one coming from the other atom, and similarly for this one. So these two are going to be involved in bonding, and this is why oxygen has a valence of two and has to form two bonds with either a double bond with one other thing or a single bond with two other things, so that these both get credit for being filled. All right? Now, those paired electrons for oxygen are not shown in this water molecule model, but they're there. And all of these electrons are negative, of course. So they're trying to avoid each other because they're like charges. Negatives are trying to get away from each other, repelling. Oxygen is in the middle of a space, and if you have four pairs of negative electrons around that center, geometrically, the most you can space them out is if you put them at the four corners of a tetrahedron, which is this shape. To you gaming nerds, it's the four-sided die. All right? Oxygen is in the middle of the thickness of that. And if you spread those four corners, or those electrons, which are negative and trying to get away from each other, to the four corners, that maximally splits them, separates them. Well, these ones that are not involved in bonding are there. The other two corners are where the hydrogens are, sharing their electrons. And that's why this geometry exists. You can predict it just by calculating that angle in a tetrahedron, and we see that that's actually exactly what it is. In methane on the bottom, this is a CH4. Carbon has a tetravalence, a valence of four, so it has to form four overall bonds. In this case, it's forming four single bonds with four different different atoms. Each of them is a hydrogen, though. Well, the hydrogens are all four corners, and that's exactly what we see in the model. All right. 18. I want to talk a little bit about a signal, or signal molecules, or chemical signals, as they're called, as opposed to an electrical signal, for instance. Signals in general are things that cause stuff to happen. that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't there. Well, some signals are actually chemicals, molecules, and those are called chemical signals. And we see two signals in this example, endorphin and morphine. There's a distinction drawn between these two, not at all having to do with what the chemical is, but just about where it's created, basically. So endorphin is an endogenous signal. The gen of this, like in generate or genesis, means create. And endo means within or inside. So an endogenous signal is one that is produced, it's created chemically within the organism. We make our own endorphin. Exogenous is the opposite, meaning occurring without or outside of. Morphine is an example of an exogenous signal, which we usually don't use that phrase. We just call an exogenous signal a drug. That's what a drug is, a chemical signal that's not made in the body but can be delivered into the body and has some effect. But I should say right there, speaking of effects, no chemical signal, whether it's a hormone, for instance, an endogenous signal, or a drug, will have any effect on any cell unless and until that signal binds to a receptor molecule. And not just any receptor molecule, but the only one that it can bind to is a receptor molecule that has just the right complementary shape to fit the signal itself, like a lock and a key, kind of. And I think, didn't I use parturition as an example of childbirth? The oxytocin that's released goes all over the body, but most of the body doesn't respond because it doesn't have the receptors to fit the oxytocin, so it doesn't even know it's there. All right? Well, receptors are proteins, just one of the many important jobs that proteins do in organisms. And here in cartoon form, they're represented by these purple membrane-bound structures. So they're tied to this membrane. And the outward-facing shape here is called the receptor site. That is the important part of the receptor. It's what makes it specific for a certain kind of signal, because only a signal with the right shape will fit into that receptor site. And only if that happens will there be any effect of the signal. If you look at endorphin, it's fairly complex molecularly, but most of this actually doesn't matter, is the point here. This part of endorphin that is in the black box is really the business end of the molecule. That's the part that has a shape that fits well into this receptor molecule. And this is also, the lock and key analogy is really good here, because the only shape, the only part of the shape of a key that matters is the part that you put into the lock, right? You can have a decorative dog head or whatever as the part that you turn. Doesn't matter. It's the part that slides into the lock that matters. Similarly, all of this is like the decorative part of your key. This matters. Well, morphine is overall very similar to endorphin, as you see here. But the part that's enclosed in a black box of morphine is very similar to the part of endorphin that works. And that's why if morphine is put into the body, it will bind to the same sort of receptors as endorphin does naturally. And it will provide some of the same effects. Endorphins naturally relieve our pain, so does morphine as a drug. But it's all because of a particle binding to a protein. And there's many examples of that, not necessarily signals, but signals are examples of ligands. Ligate, a verb, the verb means to tie. Surgically, you can talk about a ligature because it's tied. So a ligand is something that ties or binds to something else, and that something else is almost always a protein. There's many examples of that. Signals are just one example. But in any instance of a ligand binding to a protein, the general consequence of that binding event is that there is a conformational change, which means a change in shape. We refer to the shape of a specific protein as its conformation. And it's that shape change that gets the ball rolling as far as changes in the cell are occurring, are concerned. When endorphin binds here, for instance, the cell wouldn't know about that if all it did was bind and nothing happened to the receptor itself. But the binding actually changes the shape of this receptor, and therefore the cell can recognize that the shape has changed and things happen because of that. That is the chapter. Might as well go to another one.